Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The broadcast today is a cautionary tale of what happens to businesses and to people after 2 years of financial crisis. I'll give you a little hint here. It's all about money and how nobody's getting any. Small businesses and personal credit scores on the broadcast today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the New Harvard Business Review. The July-August issue is on newsstands now, featuring an in-depth interview with Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz. And by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kyle Risdahl. Good to have you with us on this Monday, everybody. It is the 12th of July today. And to the list of things given a thrashing by the Great Recession and financial crisis of the past 2 years or so, that would be employment, consumer confidence, real estate, and the stock markets. You can now add personal credit scores. FICO, the company that helped create the credit score industry, said today that 25% of us now have scores below 600. That is a sizable bump from pre-recession days. It also means more of us are going to have trouble getting affordable credit. Joan Goldwasser writes for Kiplinger's Personal Finance magazine. Joan, it's good to have you here.
Nice to be with you.
Is it surprising to you that a quarter of the people out there have credit scores below 600?
Not terribly surprising. I mean, we know that people's credit scores have been dropping. If you've foreclosed on your home, that does terrible things to your credit score. It drops it about 150 points. If you stop paying your credit cards because you just can't afford to, that also will do really bad things to your credit score.
Play it out for me a little bit in terms of the entire economy. The economic recovery is dependent on people getting out and spending more and consumers being more active. Yet, if they can't get those loans, they can't do that. So the economic recovery sort of doesn't really get going anywhere.
That's right. I mean, consumer spending accounts for about two-thirds of our economy. So people will be buying the necessities of life, but they won't be buying new cars. They're not going to be buying houses. People are paying down their debts, which is good for their personal balance sheets. But as you said, it's not great for the economy.
Speaking of people paying down their debts, there's also been a jump in people whose credit scores are over 800. That is, the people who can are paying off their debts, paying off their credit, and so their scores are going up.
That's what they call the super prime category. And those people will actually see credit card offers in the mail. And they will be for rewards cards and low balance or 0% balance transfer offers. They're people that everybody wants to have in their folios.
People who probably don't need more credit, right?
Probably not.
All right. Well, from super prime then to subprime, I guess, there's been a jump in the number of people with credit scores nearing 300, pretty much the bottom of the barrel. How do you survive in such a credit-oriented economy when you can't get credit?
You probably don't have a credit card. But if you need to borrow money, if your car needs to be repaired or you get sick, you're really in a bad shape and you may be forced to go to a payday lender or somebody that's going to charge you a usurious rate of interest.
Which will do eventually nothing for your credit score, right?
Oh, no. You'll probably just get deeper in debt.
We've had this amazing credit event the past 2.5-3 years in this economy. Credit scores are completely out of whack. Might lenders now say, well, you know, I mean, a 600 is okay, 550, we can do that. And they won't be looking for the 750, 800 credit score people anymore?
We haven't seen any evidence of that. What we've been seeing is really the opposite. People who have credit cards have seen their interest rates go up. We've seen the credit lines cut back. I mean, we've seen banks try to get their own balance sheets in better shape. And I don't know whether they're going to start to be more lenient now.
So I have a confession to make. You ready?
Sure.
Before I bought my first house, I had no idea what my credit score was. I would not have known how to find it if you had told me. Are we now, in light of the credit problems we've had, paying too much attention to credit scores? And if people just paid their bills and did what they were supposed to do financially, wouldn't everything work out?
Well, actually, it would. Your credit score doesn't really matter at all if you're not in the market for credit. I mean, it's going to fluctuate a little bit, and it doesn't really matter. It's only if you're about to make a large purchase within the next 6 months to a year, that you want to be careful about what your credit score is and make sure that you don't do anything that will harm it.
Yeah. And then, of course, by the time you figure it out and you're about to buy that house and you figure out you have a credit score of 427, it's too late.
That's true. If it's that bad, you're in real trouble.
Joan Goldwasser from Kiplinger's Personal Finance Magazine. Joan, thanks so much for your time.
Very welcome.
On Wall Street today, things were up and then they were down and then they pretty much broke even. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right, so you take an economy, you wrap it in 2+ years of tightening credit, deteriorating spending, and an overall case of the blahs, and what do you get? Lots of things, of course, not many of them good. One of them is the curious case of small businesses. Even though they create most of the new jobs that we get in this economy, they can't get enough cash. And the chairman of the Federal Reserve wants to do something about that. At a conference in Washington today, Ben Bernanke said that banks ought to lend more to small businesses that need it. From the Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting, Mitchell Hartman reports.
Fed Chair Bernanke said today that even small businesses with strong cash flows can't get bank loans to fund operations and expand employment. Bob Coleman publishes a trade newsletter on small business lending. He says it's really the slightly bigger than mom-and-pop shops that are having the most trouble borrowing.
The person who's employing 50 to 100 people, that market has completely dried up in terms of credit.
To get loans flowing to creditworthy businesses, Bernanke wants bank regulators to ease up on underwriting standards. But Bill Dunkelberg, chairman of Libertyville Bank in New Jersey, doesn't think that'll help much.
Well, we are lending to any good loan applicant that comes in. The problem is that a lot of good borrowers are on the sidelines.
He says the economy just hasn't improved enough for those businesses to risk borrowing yet. Dunkelberg is also chief economist at the National Federation of Independent Business. He says a lot of small businesses just aren't a good credit risk right now.
70% of those who were trying to get a loan really wanted it just for cash flow, which really meant they were having just financial stress. They weren't out there trying to borrow to expand or hire or to buy new equipment.
But not every small business is still hurting.
For us, this year's been really good. I mean, we can hardly keep up with all the orders we have coming in.
Randy Delwo's company, RBD Instruments in Bend, Oregon, makes measurement devices for manufacturers. Delwo has 12 employees. He says his bank credit line has remained steady, but he needs a $500,000 loan to finish R&D on a new product line and expand sales. He knows there's a market there, but his bank's not interested in taking the risk. Not a single bank he's contacted in the past year is.
Even companies that have good equity and credit and good history are still having a hard time getting capital. If we could be funded, we could create jobs like right now, today. We could hire new people.
Instead, Delwo's on the slow road to expansion and won't be hiring additional workers anytime soon. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Tomorrow, our government advisory panel is going to start considering the fate of GlaxoSmithKline's blockbuster diabetes drug, Avandia. It's been linked to heart attacks and stroke, and the company is facing thousands of lawsuits. What the panel decides over the next 2 days could set the standard for the scientific analysis that the FDA uses to make its decisions. From the Marketplace Health Desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Gregory Warner reports.
The gold standard at the FDA for analyzing drugs is called the randomized clinical trial. Flip a coin and people with heads get the drug. Everybody else gets a placebo. The problem is that only big drug companies can afford to sponsor a randomized trial, and they only last a year or two.
If you're diagnosed as a diabetic at age 25, 30, you could be on a drug like Avandia for a period of 30 years.
Daniel Carpenter is a professor at Harvard and author of a new book about the FDA called Reputation and Power. He says there's a better and cheaper way to look at health risks of drugs over time. You study the medical history of lots of people already taking the drug. Those are the kinds of studies that linked Avandia and heart attacks.
And if the Avandia drug is pulled off the market, that's going to set a precedent whereby other drugs, including drugs that are currently being sold, could be pulled off the market on the basis of observational studies.
That worries Bob Goldberg at the Center for Medicine and the Public Interest. He says observational studies are subjective and easy to manipulate.
It speaks to the effect that unnuanced analysis of tabloid medicine has on science.
Daniel Carpenter says that observational studies probably wouldn't be a factor at the FDA.
but for the fact that there are some doubts hanging over GlaxoSmithKline's ability to run its clinical trials.
If the FDA decides to pull Avandia, it means it doesn't trust the clinical trial research that GlaxoSmithKline has presented, and that could ripple through the industry. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
To some, Hugh Hefner is a weird old dude who walks around in his pajamas and has girlfriends who are way too young for him. To others, though, the guy who founded Playboy almost 60 years ago is nothing short of a genius. Either way you think, Hefner's company is in trouble. Hef owns about 70% of Playboy, and he said today he wants to buy out the rest, take it private, and keep all those bunnies to himself. By bunnies here, we really do mean bunnies, the company's iconic logo. Marketplace's Eve Troe reports it has become the cotton tail that wags the brand.
Hefner's famously said a Playboy centerfold should look like the girl next door. Well, with the rise of free adult content on the internet that might show the actual girl next door, demand for paid Playboy content has shrunk. Steve Marascia follows the company for Capital Securities Management. He says the magazine is invaluable, even though it's losing money.
It keeps the name out in front of the public. Now what they're doing is transitioning to where the brand side of the business does tend to produce more sales.
That brand, of course, is the iconic bunny. Playboy wants to slap that long-eared logo on everything in sight. Marascia says it's a radical move that'll be easier to make as a private company, one that doesn't have to answer to shareholders. Playboy already has its own fragrance and clothing line. It's announced two new Playboy clubs in Asia. It's even hopped into the beverage business.
Playboy energy drink, sugar-free and regular.
They keep trying to put it where they're putting it. It's not going to work.
Wendy Liebman is CEO of WSL Strategic Retail. She's seen the bunny on everything from rhinestone jewelry to hot pink pillows. She says the company has moved away from Hef's more tasteful vision for the brand.
It certainly has been marginalized over this last decade, where it's been on everything cheap and cheesy that you could ever imagine. So I suppose if anybody's going to reinvigorate it, it's the father of it all.
Hefner might not get the chance. He owns the majority of the company's stock, but other shareholders have to sign off on his bid to buy the rest. Many say his price is too low. And then there's the rival magazine Penthouse. That company's CEO said today that he's preparing a counteroffer, one that might be more of a turn-on for investors. I'm Eve Troe for Marketplace.
Traveling is great, unless you have to. Hours upon hours of standing in security lines at the airport, eating lousy conference food when you get there, and living out of a suitcase, the fun just kind of gets sucked right out of it. In our series, Road Warriors, producer Michael Rayfield is introducing us to the soundtracks that people choose when they are away from home, often working more than 9 to 5. Today's guest spends a lot of time on the road, both listening to and playing music.
I'm Aaron Dyer, and I'm in the band Buchan Gase, along with my friend Aaron Sanchez. When we're on the road, I really enjoy listening to Disco Balls by Flying Lotus. Picture the two of us in the front seats, but the back seat is full of, well, the kick drum, a pillow, the cooler, bags of snack foods. I do enjoy it when it's just 8 hours. I really don't like getting a backache where, you know, my left butt cheek kind of falls asleep and then my right foot gets cramped, my shoulders hurt. Just being in pain is generally the downfall. Disco Balls is something that both of us don't have to analyze. Both of us are super analytical when it comes to songs, but this song is, it just feels good, and that's really what it's about. is that it's something that I can relax to and also move to and also dream off the planet to. You know, the only part about my job, quote unquote, that's actually work is the practicing and the stuff where I'm doing here, where I'm making CDs or making T-shirts or emails. That's the only part about it that's work. But, you know, going on tour is like a vacation.
In response to popular demand, we've got a brand new music section on our website. That's where you can check out Aaron's other favorites or offer up your own playlist. Find out what's on the show that day. It's all on our homepage, marketplace.org. Coming up, commercial real estate and oil don't mix.
How many charter boats do we have financed? How many beach restaurants? How many beach businesses? We have loans to realtors just for them to operate and run and maintain their businesses.
But first, let's do the numbers. Investors took a wait-and-see approach ahead of a new round of corporate earnings today. The Dow Industrials added 18 points, not quite 0.2%, finished at 10,216. The NASDAQ nudged a single point higher, just shy of 0.1%, 2,198 at the bell. The S&P 500 eked out a tiny advance, less than a point, to finish virtually flat at 1,078. That's still enough to qualify as the fifth straight day in positive territory, though, for the S&P anyway. The cautious mood set in ahead of Alcoa's latest profit report, and skittish investors dinged the stock by 0.2%. Appears they need not have worried, though. After the bell, the aluminum producer posted a 22% increase in sales. A couple of tech stocks were big winners on analyst upgrades today. SanDisk shares jumped almost 7% there. Qualcomm climbed almost 3.5%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Gather.com, the social network where people can make new friends who share their interests. People talking about today's news at news.gather.com. And by Vanguard, a client-owned company where the clients own the funds and the funds own the company. Learn more at Vanguard.com. Every day, be sure to wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report. It's 8 minutes of radio you can't afford to miss. You'll hear updates on all the latest developments in business and finance as they happen.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. NASA begins a two-day meeting on new investments in space technology. The Commerce Department releases international trade figures for the month of May. And 32 years ago, Henry Ford II fired Lee Iacocca, who then became the president of Chrysler Corporation 1 year later. I'm Cormac O'Connor.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Last week's crazy triple-digit East Coast heat wave is just a memory. Now, New York is a relatively sane 92 degrees today. Of course, that still has air conditioners pegged at maximum cool, and it's the same in other parts of the country, too. It doesn't have to be 100 degrees for us to hit the AC to be comfortable. Not all that long ago, though, we all survived just fine without conditioning the air. In his new book, Losing Our Cool, author Stan Cole says air conditioning actually has made us worse off. Stan, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you.
Do I have it right that you survived Kansas summers with no air conditioning in your house?
That's right. Our house does have a central air conditioning system. We turn it on for one day a year to make sure it's still in good working order.
Is that a day of celebration and happiness in your house, or do you do it reluctantly?
We usually time it for when people are coming over to dinner or we have out-of-town visitors.
This book you have written is very much a proposal that we should just figure out a way to do without it, or certainly do less of it.
I knew that if I wrote a book calling for the prohibition of air conditioning, I wouldn't get very far with most people. So what I tried to do instead is paint a picture of what life might be like if we start reducing our dependence on it.
Give me some sense of the raw number. How much energy do we use to keep ourselves cool and comfortable?
Well, the number is approaching a half trillion kilowatt hours per year, which is doesn't mean a lot unless you think of it as the entire electricity consumption of all 60 nations of the continent of Africa, almost a billion people per year for everything. We could also compare it to renewable energy, solar, wind, biomass, geothermal. Those sources could increase fivefold and still would not cover our demand for air conditioning in this country.
Are we doing air conditioning any smarter than we did in the past? I mean, have we taken advantage of technology to at least use less energy per degree of cooling or however it's measured?
Well, that, in fact, has been improved significantly. Comparing with the mid-90s, the efficiency of residential air conditioners that are in use has increased 28%. But at the same time, the average air-conditioned home is using 37% more electricity for cooling, which seems like a paradox until you think about the fact that houses have gotten much bigger and that a lot of people have switched, say, from room air conditioning to central air and are probably keeping their houses cooler.
You know, if you walk down the street in the summertime in most of Los Angeles, certainly New York City, and I'd bet there in Salina, Kansas as well where you are, and everybody's got their air conditioning on, there are no people out there, right? There's nobody with windows open, sitting on the porch anymore. You lose a certain social aspect to this because of AC, don't you?
That was one of the chief reasons I wrote the book, was the ill ease I felt in going through neighborhoods that I knew had once been very lively places in summer and had been turned into dead zones. You would not see any human life out there, and the only sound would be the compressors and fans on air conditioners. And I really do believe that what has been called by one author nature deficit disorder is a problem that has been facilitated by air conditioning. You can make a dark home entertainment center with cool, still, dry air a lot more appealing than a meadow, say, in summer.
Stan Cox, his most recent book is called Losing Our Cool. Stan, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
We've got a whole list of Stan's tips for how to stay cool without turning on the air conditioning, should you be of a mind to. It's on our website, marketplace.org. The White House has gone back to the well, if you will, in its efforts to stop deepwater offshore drilling. Interior Secretary Ken Salazar released a revamped moratorium this afternoon, one the administration hopes will meet the requirements of the federal judge down in New Orleans, who threw out the first attempt. And as that oil spreads to beaches in Florida, everybody's got worries about tourism. But Jay Field reports now from Pensacola that investors and developers are bracing for what they fear could be a commercial real estate bust.
I'm standing on Pensacola Beach with my back to the Gulf of Mexico. You can see the remnants of the tar balls that have been washing ashore here for a few weeks now. In front of me is the next big multi-million dollar resort due to open up here. You can see the outlines of its 206 rooms and balconies, but it's still more concrete and cement skeleton than actual hotel.
It's the most out of control I've ever felt since I started my company 25 years ago.
Julian McQueen, who develops and runs hotels, is building this one. It's a Holiday Inn.
That sense of helplessness would cause me not to build anything new if I was in the position to make that decision. However,
he isn't now. Construction on the beach hotel and another one McQueen is building in Alabama is too far along to stop. He's already sunk $78 million into them, but the oil spill affected his business long before any oil washed up here.
We watched the pace of reservations start to denigrate beginning the first week in May, really. It started to be affected, and it continued to go down and down and down.
By the end of June, a time that's normally the busiest of the year,
McQueen's seven other Gulf Coast hotels were generating half their normal revenues.
That's not sustainable. We'll have to do massive layoffs, and if you take that to the extreme, we'll have to stop paying our mortgages, and we'll have to start looking at some plan of wrapping up our business.
A few weeks ago, McQueen filed his first claim with BP to cover millions in lost revenue. He says he thinks the oil company will help him, but who's going to help the regional banks that lend the money for projects like his? That's exactly what Buzz Ritchie is worried about. He runs Gulf Coast Community Bank. He started studying his $200 million loan portfolio the minute the oil began flowing.
How many charter boats do we have financed? How many beach restaurants? How many beach businesses? We have loans to realtors just for them to operate and run and maintain their businesses.
Regional banks have a lot on the line, says economist Rick Harper. He's at the University of West Florida. He estimates Panhandle banks have lent out about $4 billion in real estate loans. They were just starting to recover from hurricanes and the burst housing bubble.
And then to have the oil spill decrease demand is very problematic.
Harper says any more damage to banks means a much longer recovery here in the Gulf. Banker Buzz Ritchie says just getting the oil leak capped would be a relief.
What's this going to amount to? How bad is it going to be, and how long is it going to hang around? And nobody can answer those questions. So business doesn't like uncertainty. Our budgets are questionable, you know, our forecasts, our game plans, our strategies.
And he says that's a tough place to be. In Pensacola Beach, Florida, I'm Jay Field for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation Defender, protecting online privacy by monitoring the web and removing your personal data from websites that sell it. ReputationDefender.com/market. And by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
A final note today, courtesy of Consumer Reports, in what might well be the electronic equivalent of Ralph Nader and Unsafe at Any Speed. Consumer Reports said today it can't in good conscience recommend that people buy the iPhone 4. It's got a flaw in the antenna design, the magazine says, which was, of course, the source of all the buzz when the phone first came out about dropped calls if you held it a certain way. Even worse for the company, perhaps, CR says Apple was dishonest in how it reacted to those dropped calls. So take that, Steve Jobs, although investors didn't really care. Apple shares down about 0.8% today. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Monday. Today, the Dow up 18 points, 0.2%. The NASDAQ up a point, almost 0.1%. The S&P 500 gained less than a point. A win, but we'll call it flat. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time on this particular radio program, career colleges say the degree is worth the price.
If you're making $10 an hour and you have $15,000 in student loans, that would be pretty difficult to pay back for anyone.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.